You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jump back in time with me for a few decades, for just a moment. Imagine you land in the town of Hyannisport, Massachusetts. While there, you see a large, beautiful two-story home, something right out of the American dream. If you wandered through the numerous rooms in this waterfront property, you may end up lingering in one of the rooms. And in this room, there's a little wooden box. This box contains index cards with the names of 9 children, each having their own card. The cards detail their medical histories and major milestones, even the day they were christened. Nearly half of the children mentioned in this homemade file died well before their 50th birthday. Some of these names you may recognize immediately, like John F. Kennedy and Robert Bobby Kennedy. But do you know the names of any of the women in this box? Do you know their stories? And for that matter, how much do you know about the woman who this box belongs to? I'm Andre, and this is the Redacted History Podcast. In this episode, we are going to tell the stories of 10 different Kennedy women. Now keep in mind, the Kennedy family is a very large family. Today we'll be revisiting the lives of Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy, the matriarch of the family, Rose Marie Kennedy, her firstborn daughter, who deserved so much better, Kathleen Kick Kennedy, her feisty second daughter, Eunice Kennedy, the middle child whose philanthropy has left a lasting impact until today, Patricia Kennedy, who created a life all her own in Hollywood, Jean Kennedy, her youngest daughter, whose political career kept the family connection to Ireland alive and well, and Rose's 4 daughter-in-laws, Joan Bennett and Victoria Reggie, who married Ted Kennedy at different points in life, Ethel Kennedy, who was married to the late Bobby Kennedy, and the iconic Jackie Kennedy, former First Lady to President John F. Kennedy. The list doesn't include the host of other relatives, the women who cared for the Kennedy children, campaigned for the Kennedys, or slept with the Kennedy men for that matter. But we may mention a few throughout this episode. This is also not getting into anything about a curse or any other conspiracy theories that you may have heard of. Without any further delay, let's get started with the woman that started it all. Rose Kennedy Fitzgerald, the matriarch of the Kennedy family. Her roots go all the way back to Ireland. Her family came to the United States in search of opportunity, and they most certainly found it. Her father, John Francis Fitzgerald, who many called Honey Fitz, was heavily involved in politics. Her mother, Mary, was a traditional woman who took pride in the role of motherhood. Rose would inherit both of those interests from her parents. Rose's father's career continued to grow, and he became increasingly more involved in politics. He went from the state senate, the U.S. House of Representatives, all the way to mayor of Boston. As a child, Rose kept up with his career, and as a teenager, she began to accompany her father on work trips as a stand-in for her mother. Her mother wasn't really interested in that sort of thing. Maybe it was here on the campaign trails she imagined her future children going into this same line of work. She was the oldest of 6 children. She learned that meant that she had more responsibility, which is an enormous amount of pressure. In addition to that, growing up in the public eye, Rose began to become increasingly more aware of her own flaws and the flaws of others. She also made it her mission to snuff out those imperfections. Perfection was the name of the game when it came to Rose. Her outfits, her hair, her teeth, and especially her weight had to be in top shape. Now, as we all know, there's no such thing as perfection, but I think Rose would laugh at something like that. She was a woman of faith and described her faith in God as her greatest gift of all. And on her walk with God, she strived for as close as she could to get to God-like perfection. Rose was very smart, and she finished high school at 16. She learned French and German. she attended Manhattanville College of the Sacred Heart. She excelled there and probably could have been a nun even if she wanted to. She loved to swim and learned about history. It was around this time she would meet the love of her life, Joseph Kennedy. Joseph Kennedy also had a rich Irish background. His lineage is traced to those fleeing to America to escape the Irish famine. His father, Patrick, aka PJ, was well known in the community as a helping hand to many. He owned a few bars and he also served in office in Massachusetts at one point. But Joseph did not have the same lavish lifestyle as Rose had growing up. Still, he worked hard and was able to get himself into Harvard and became very successful in the banking industry and some lucky investments. He even became president of Columbia Trust Bank at the age of just 25. But all that did not matter. Massachusetts is a small state and the Irish American community was close-knit. Back in these days, in the 19th century into the early to mid 20th century, to be Irish was to be looked down upon by the white residents of America, the white Americans. The term for these individuals is WASP, meaning white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. In this case, if you were Irish, Italian, Greek, Portuguese, you were the wrong kind of white. Not even really white at all, unlike how we view whiteness today. Rose and her family, even with their wealth and notoriety, were frequently discouraged to live in certain neighborhoods and flat out denied entry to certain social clubs. So because of this community created out of exclusion and shared culture, Rose's father knew exactly who Joseph was, and he did not approve. He was nowhere near good enough for his daughter. He was convinced that Joseph just had business savvy and suspected there was something shady going on with his investments. Even today, people talk about his connections to organized crime. But he was good enough for Rose. They would continue to date semi-secretly for about 7 years. They would frequently write each other and sneak away to spend time together whenever possible. He would even visit her at school when her father was not visiting, of course. And they would go on to get married October 7th, 1914, even though Rose's father disapproved heavily. Rose was smitten, and there was nothing that could be done to keep these two apart. No more than 9 months after their honeymoon, she gave birth to their first child, Joseph Jr., October of 1915. Not long after, on May 29, 1917, John F. Kennedy was born. And not long after him, her first girl, Rose Marie Kennedy, was born. Rose wanted to get pregnant as soon as possible. Plus, being a strict Catholic, birth control was not an option. Part of her calling was to raise a large family. She also thought it was best not to breastfeed. It was too time-consuming and she had places to be and people to see. Being a mother wasn't going to rob her of also having a life. She was also the founder of the Ace of Clubs organization, which she established in response to not being allowed to join other society clubs because she was Irish and Catholic. This club was the club for high society single ladies to discuss their experiences. She saw motherhood as her primary career, and just like any other job, there is professional time and then there's personal time. The children grew up with cooks and nannies, and Rose stepped in to teach them life's lessons and push them to reach perfection. Some reports say that JFK does not recall her having ever hugged him as a child, but she loved her children. They were her life's work. She and her husband pushed them to compete and excel. She was known to involve them in political discussions at a young age. They had to know geography, history, and policy. She even had their IQs tested. As adults, she was even known to correct them on speeches they had given. She was obsessed with their dental hygiene even back then. If you look at photos of the Kennedys, they all had wonderful teeth. And because so many of her children had health issues, they kept very detailed records in their little wooden box. She also weighed them frequently. If they gained or lost a pound, she knew about it. This ended up creating an unhealthy relationship with food in some of the Kennedy children. Eunice, for example, even as an adult, was 5'10" and no more than 110 pounds. But things were about to get more complicated for Rose's labor of love. Her third child and first daughter, Rose Marie, usually called Rosemary, was going to enter the world next. Rosemary's first few minutes of life were tumultuous. When her mother went into labor, the doctor was busy attending to other patients. During this time, the country was experiencing the Spanish flu, so he was needed elsewhere. Rose was instructed to wait for the doctor as long as she could, but this baby was coming. Rose was told to keep her legs closed tight together. At one point, it is said that Rosemary was even pushed back up the birth canal until the doctor arrived, 2 hours later. Rose was excited to have a girl, part of the reason why she was named Rose Marie in her mother's honor, but this perfectionist slowly started to see that her daughter was a little different. She was not hitting developmental milestones at the same rate as her previous children. Rose was concerned, but she was hopeful that her daughter would catch up. Concerned turned into full worry by the time she had her next two daughters, Kathleen and Eunice. They were both surpassing Rosemary in certain developmental areas. The family tried everything, tutors, switching schools, and plenty of prayer. They thought that if they pushed her, she would rise to the occasion. Perhaps it was just denial. We see this even today. A child is diagnosed with developmental issues, autism or ADHD, and denial immediately sets in a lot of families. Parents believe that by giving their children extra accommodations, they are stifling them. But many educators would advise against this sentiment. Rosemary would have gone on to live a completely different life if her parents recognized and used the right tools to help her advance. But since ableism and ignorance got in the way, nothing helped Rosemary reach her full potential. Rosemary was diagnosed with mental retardation. Of course, we know that term is outdated and heavily taboo. Regardless, Rosemary did have an intellectual disability. The severity of her disability is said to have been exaggerated heavily. But most historians believe her cognitive disability, even as she aged, would not exceed that of about a 12-year-old. The most widely believed theory is that she was deprived of oxygen during the birthing process, which caused her intellectual disabilities later on in life. Rose and her husband had no idea what to do, even though they had the money and resources. Back in these days, the most common practice was to institutionalize your loved one and/or have them forcibly sterilized. So when you hear people say back then certain conditions didn't exist or they didn't know anyone who was disabled, it's because disabled people were literally snuffed out of society and abandoned. One thing that her parents did do well for her is they made sure that her siblings always included her. If they were sailing, Eunice was excited to go out on the water with her sister. If they attended a dance, the expectation was that Rosemary danced too, even if it was just with her brothers. When they went to Europe because Joseph had become ambassador to the UK in 1938, she was on the Queen's Court alongside her sister Kathleen. If you look up the photos, she was absolutely beautiful. While in Europe, she also attended a Montessori school, which was much better suited for her needs. And when she was starting to adjust to the curriculum, she was showing improvement in areas she previously struggled. But then the family moved back to America in response to World War II. And it was all downhill from there for Rosemary. Being in a family of overachievers where perfection is the standard and winning is the only thing that matters was pretty difficult for her. She just quite frankly did not fit in. It also didn't help that her parents, especially Joseph, just wanted her to be like everyone else. The move back to America triggered Rosemary. She began having seizures more frequently. She began to act out even more. She would have these fits and she would try to run away. It was suspected that she was meeting boys and could end up pregnant. This deeply concerned her mother because a few years prior, there was this major case involving Charles Lyndon Byrd Jr., a baby not yet 2 years old who was taken from his home and murdered. If any of our listeners have an interest in true crime, you may already be familiar with the disturbing details of this case. Needless to say, Rose was terrified that someone would take advantage of Rosemary and kidnap her. They were also worried about what Rosemary's behavior would do to the family's reputation. After all, the Kennedy men were all being groomed to take office one day at this point. When she was 23 years old, her father, Joseph, had an idea on how he could finally fix Rosemary. It's heartbreaking because in some of her letters that she wrote to him, she talks about how she would want nothing more than to make him proud because she knew she didn't meet the family's expectations. No child should feel that way. He took Rosemary in for a lobotomy. The family had heard of the procedure but decided it was not a good fit for Rosemary. Those of you who are unfamiliar with what a lobotomy is, a lobotomy involves taking an instrument and inserting it into the brain to disconnect or remove part of the frontal lobe from the rest of the brain. We don't have to explain why this procedure was incredibly dangerous. And back then, if you didn't fit the social norms, if you were mentally ill in any way that was disruptive even, if you were gay, lobotomy was said to be the solution. If you're unfamiliar with the structure of the brain, your frontal lobe is the part of your brain where your personality is, the functions involving emotions, self-control, etc. So the idea was that by correcting the frontal lobe, you were going to be corrected of any of these unwanted behaviors. The lobotomies that were considered successful often left people a shell of their former selves, a zombie. It also resulted in some pretty long-term effects, everything from headaches to seizures, and of course, death. Rosemary's lobotomy didn't kill her, but it did kill so many things that made her Rosemary. During the procedure, it was clear that something had gone very wrong. Rosemary left the procedure with the cognitive abilities of about a 2-year-old. She would no longer be able to sail, dance with her siblings, write letters to her mother, or care for herself in any way. Horrified by the outcome, her father, Joseph, sent her further north to be institutionalized at Craig House. She was moved when JFK was picking up his political career to the Coletta School for Exceptional Children in Wisconsin. While there, her father saw to it that she have her own tiny house and care. But other than that, her father never visited her. He also told the nurses to make sure that she had no other visitors. So it had been nearly 20 years before Rosemary would see her family again. Joseph Kennedy had a stroke in 1961, and it finally came out what happened to Rosemary and where she was. It's ironic because his stroke left him barely able to speak and unable to care for himself. He told no one that he had her sent away. It's not clear if his wife Rose even knew. There were definitely signs that something tragic had happened to Rosemary, but the family was taught not to question their father. He, after all, was the head of the family. He told the family that she had moved to become a teacher, so they all just believed him and moved on. But with Joseph no longer calling the shots, the family integrated Rosemary back into the fold. They also became huge advocates for those who were differently abled. JFK also pushed legislation to provide essential programs for those like Rosemary. A good example of this was the Community Mental Health Act of 1963, which provided federal funding for community mental health centers and research facilities devoted to the causes and treatments of mental retardation. Eunice was especially happy to see her sister again and visited her often and helped care for her. Kathleen Kennedy, also known as Kick, would never see her sister Rosemary again. Her nickname being Kick was definitely appropriate. She was born February 20th, 1920, and as we mentioned before, she was a debutante in Britain and was a huge socialite. Long before she was in the global spotlight, she had boys fighting over who would dance with her as a teenager. Rose, of course, was not a fan of this. She wanted her daughter to be a little bit more conservative and a little less concerned with boys. But just the same as Rose, she had a good heart. She volunteered with the Red Cross and went back to England in 1943 to volunteer at the hospitals there in support of the war effort. She loved London and had a flourishing social life there too. It was there that she reconnected with William Cavendish. He was in line to be a duke, which meant she was destined to be a duchess. They had crossed paths before when he was in London, but this time was different. They were in love, but the family was not a fan of William. They thought that Kathleen was straying too far away from her Catholic values. But she was going to marry him just the same. The only Kennedy that showed up at her wedding was Joseph, her older brother. Her other brothers would have attended but had prior engagements, but there was no way her parents were going to show up. They had been living in marital bliss for just a few short weeks before William was killed. He was shot down during the war on the front line. The future she imagined for them was gone. Am I the only one that feels like life as an adult in America doesn't come with an off switch? There's always something to pay for, whether it's rent, living expenses, household expenses, or God forbid, I want to treat myself to a special night out, or I want to get a last minute gift for a loved one during the holidays, or an unexpected trip to the vet, or my car breaks down, or there's rent due again, or something on a long list of never-ending things to do and pay for. And life doesn't happen bi-weekly, so why should payday? The money you earn can be in your hands today with Earnin'. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck, then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in redacted_podcast when you sign in. It'll really help the show. redacted_podcast. Subject to your available earnings, location, daily max, and pay period max. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. A few months after that, the entire Kennedy family would endure a devastating blow. The oldest brother of the Kennedy family, Joseph Kennedy Jr., would die in a plane crash at the age of 29. His body would never be fully recovered because the plane exploded. He was the family pride and joy. He and Kick were also very close. Kick was devastated and found companionship with a man who was already married, Earl Fitzwilliam. Of course, Rose was not having it and told her daughter that if she did not simmer down, that she would be cut off. But Kick was in love and nothing was going to stand in the way between her and her man, except for maybe his wife. She did eventually get him to leave his wife, but there was a stipulation. He would leave his wife and marry Kick only if Kick's family signed off on the nuptials. She was still in Europe and her family was going to be in France, so she went down to Paris so that she could get her father's blessing. The plan was to get back on a plane and fly to Paris. The next destination was the French Riviera to vacation and celebrate. Unfortunately, she would never make it there, and everyone died on the plane crash. Her father attended her funeral. She was 28 at the time. So by 1948, the Kennedy clan had lost two siblings and a sister who was somewhere in the country, institutionalized, unbeknownst to them. They had all been instructed to just put this out of their minds and not ask too many questions. It's no wonder that Patricia, the fourth Kennedy daughter, would seek refuge far away from her family in the land of dreamers. Patricia was born May 6, 1924. She, like many of her siblings, battled her own set of health issues, but she kept up with the rest of the Kennedy family. In one story, during a scavenger hunt, she stole a bus that was left unattended in an effort to bring back the longest item to her group of siblings. Much like her sisters, she attended a convent school, but her main interest was films. So one of Joseph Kennedy's financial advisors was in Hollywood. He made movies and he definitely fooled around with an actress or two in her day. And Patricia took an interest in that world as well. In addition to convent school, she also attended Rosemont College in Pennsylvania. She became more and more involved in the theater and, of course, finished with a degree in the arts. Like with most people interested in pursuing a career in the movie industry, she moved to LA. But while she was in LA, she started out as an assistant to a very popular radio host named Kate Smith. She continued to work her way up. She also kept in touch with her family, but from a distance, and was still supportive during her brother's political careers. She attended the well-known tea parties for JFK. But still, her heart was in Hollywood, and when she got married, her husband would actually be a pretty big deal in terms of publicity. She was married to none other than Peter Lawford in 1954. Some of you may be wondering, who in the hell is Peter Lawford? Well, Peter Lawford was a member of the Rat Pack. You may now be wondering, what is the Rat Pack? The Rat Pack was a group of talented individuals including Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Mickey Rooney, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin. They sang together, they were in movies together. One of the more notable movies is the original Ocean 11 of 1960. He was also the last person to speak to Marilyn Monroe before she died. They spoke on the phone and it was clear that she was a little unwell. But her last words on the phone call were, "Say goodbye to Pat," meaning Patricia. "Say goodbye to the president and say goodbye to yourself because you're a nice guy." Once they got married, Patricia turned her interest and her energy into being a wife and a mother. They would have four children together and she would actually be one of the few Kennedys to not have a home in Hyannisport. Based on what I've learned about her, she seemed to be that relative that loves her family but is perfectly fine with doing her own thing. She enjoyed living the California dream, for a while. But her family was introduced to several celebrities. I mean, Frank Sinatra was the one who first called Jackie Kennedy America's queen and met the family. Unfortunately for Patricia, the couple didn't have the lifelong happy ending that she may have hoped for. They ended up getting a divorce. It wasn't all good times. Peter, like many of the men that Patricia knew, was an adulterer. He also had problems with addiction. After John F. Kennedy's passing and her divorce was finalized, Patricia found herself also struggling with alcoholism. Unfortunately, she would not be the first Kennedy to battle an addiction. Her mother, Rose, was firm on not drinking, not only because she wanted to avoid the drunk Irish stereotype, but because she knew the very real dangers of picking up a bottle for comfort. Patricia would pass away in September of 2006 from pneumonia. She was 82 at the time. Before passing away, she did like many of the other Kennedy women and made her mark on the world. She established the National Committee for Literary Art and was heavily involved with the National Center on Addiction. Eunice Kennedy Shriver was the middle child, and like Patricia, she also wanted to leave a positive mark on the world. Perhaps being stuck in the middle was why she was so invested in making others feel seen. She was very observant and journaled constantly. It is because of her that we know so much about the family. Part of the reason we want to highlight the Kennedy women is because there was very clear plans for the Kennedy men. The women, on the other hand, were thought to grow up and be like Rose. But Eunice wanted to make something of herself. And regardless of what society or even her family said about her, she was going to channel her life into something of purpose. Once again, like the others, she attended convent school. But then she graduated from Stanford with a degree in sociology. When John F. Kennedy decided to run for Senate, Eunice had an idea. They would host tea parties so that women could get to know the family and JFK. They leaned into the charm that he had over women, and she knew that if more women could meet him, they would vote for him. And she was right. There was a huge challenge getting people to vote for a very young Irish-American Catholic. But the challenge was no match for the creativity of Eunice and the support of the Kennedy women, including their cousin Pauline. With JFK in the Senate, Eunice moved to be closer to the action. There, they would share a townhome together before he ran for president. And when he finally decided to run, she was heavily involved in his campaign. All of the sisters, and of course Rose, were on board too. Once he was elected, Eunice made him promise not to forget people like Rosemary were out there, and that he would have to help them. With her input, a team of 27 professionals were elected to address the concerns of this underserviced community. It was because of her, JFK pushed through much of the legislation and funding that he did for the disabled community. Even in her final years, she was invested in improving rights for those with disabilities. It was clear that well before she was associated with the Special Olympics, she had care and compassion for others. That's right, Eunice Kennedy Shriver founded Camp Shriver that grew into the Special Olympics that we know today. She would even become pretty good friends with a notorious spy. Velva Lee Dickinson, a World War II spy and presumed traitor, was in jail when she caught the interest of Eunice. She went on to work for Eunice as a secretary and even attended her wedding. Her career is filled with experiences of her working as a social worker and working in women's shelters and with the youth. She seemed to have it all. She was always giving back and even found love. She would marry Sergeant Shriver. He loved her dearly, although at first she was not interested. She was going to continue her humanitarian work and maybe even become a nun. So having a husband doesn't really fit into that plan. But he continued to try and change her mind. He had a little help too from the president of Oxford. They married in 1953 and stayed married. Together they had 5 children. But most importantly, she continued to care for her sister Rosemary until her death in 2005. And Eunice would die a few years later in 2009 at the age of 88. Last but most certainly not least, we have the youngest daughter, Jean Kennedy Smith. Being the youngest child meant Jean got to learn from all of her siblings' mistakes without having to repeat them herself. She was a little more socially recluse. She liked to keep to herself, but just because she wasn't the most talkative didn't mean that she wasn't fully aware of what was going on around her. She had so many memories of her family, like JFK winning the presidential election, running around with Ted because he was her little brother. She talked about growing up and how one of their mother's favorite forms of punishment was to lock them in a closet and make them think about how bad they had been. Jean was born on February 20th, 1928. And if you remember, Joe Kennedy had a stroke in 1961 when Jean would have been about 33 years old. It's not surprising that her political career as a woman really took off when her father's stronghold over the family had been loosened a little bit. She was married in 1956, and much like her other sisters, she attended convent school and was heavily involved in campaigning and the political happenings of the time. She was even there when her brother Bobby was shot and killed at the Ambassador Hotel. In 1974, she founded Very Special Arts. This organization is dedicated to providing funding to the arts program for children with different disabilities. The program is widespread and global, and no doubt inspired by her older sister, Rosemary. During the interview, she tells a story about the time Muhammad Ali visited the Kennedy Center, and she had the chance to show him around. She introduced herself as Jean Kennedy Smith and jokes that she should drop the Smith. In 1993, Bill Clinton appointed her ambassador to Ireland. At this time, Ireland was experiencing a lot of internal civil unrest, known as the Troubles. The conflict dragged on for about 30 years. Thousands of lives were lost, and Jean is credited with being largely involved in bringing peace to Ireland. She's been given several awards over the years and also a Presidential Medal of Freedom given to her by Barack Obama. With her, the line of Kennedy children ended. She was the last to die at the age of 92.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, let's get to the person that you're all going to recognize, Jackie Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy Onassis was born to John Bouvier III, a.k.a. Black Jack, and Janet Bouvier, July 28, 1929, in Southampton, New York. Her mother stressed the importance of being financially stable. Her father made very good money from investments. They were all very well-dressed and very well-rounded, and Jackie was sort of the clear favorite between her and her sister Lee, as far as her father was concerned. They were very close, and she was truly a daddy's girl. Her and her little sister would be constant competition for the remainder of their two lives. It was an interesting love-hate relationship for them. Their parents fought frequently, and when her father lost a large chunk of his fortune, that was her mother's final straw. She was done. So it was no surprise that when her parents got divorced, it was devastating. She taught her daughters to marry a man with money, and not like her father, but a generational wealth. And her mother did remarry very well to Hugh D. Auchincloss Jr., a multimillionaire. They were brought up to be wives to wealthy men. That was the expectation. But that wasn't really Jackie's thing. Don't get me wrong. Jackie was definitely accustomed to a certain lifestyle. She loved to shop. She loved to have the best thing, and she loved to be fashionable. She loved art, and she wasn't going to spare an expense when it came to those things. But she also had other interests, and she didn't just sit around brushing her hair waiting to marry rich. Jackie loved photography, journalism, and she enjoyed poetry. So when she attended high society balls, she was kind of bored. Her lack of initiative was beginning to show, though, when her younger sister married before her in April of 1953. Back then, to have your younger sister married before you and you're only getting up there in age was a huge thing, even though Jackie was still in her 20s, but she was getting older and older by the day in the eyes of high society. But in the spirit of competition, Jackie was going to snag an eligible bachelor soon enough. And not just any eligible bachelor, but the most eligible bachelor in the country. John F. Kennedy was a senator, and they hit it off pretty quick. They met at a friend's home where she actually had a chance to interview him. He proposed in the middle of 1952, just 3 months after her sister had been married. It's debatable as whether or not this was truly love or if it was just more strategic. Around this time, JFK had a reputation for being quite the ladies' man, so having a wife, especially a wife like Jackie, would improve his chances at the White House. But Jackie was definitely in love. Later on, she would write a poem called Meanwhile in Massachusetts that is about him. A portion of it reads, "Part he was of New England stock, as stubborn, close-guarded as Plymouth Rock. He thought with his feet most firm on the ground, but his heart and his dreams were not earthbound. He would call New England his place and his creed, but part he was of an alien breed, of a breed that had laughed on Irish hills and heard the voices in Irish reels." And their wedding was the event of the year, but I'm getting ahead of myself. When JFK proposed to Jackie, he did not tell any of his family. In fact, they had not even met Jackie. And when they did meet her, they weren't really the biggest fan. She could definitely keep up with the Kennedys. She could play their games, she could sell, and she was comfortable out on the water. But she did not truly fit in with them. The women of the Kennedy family were very supportive and very involved with politics, just like Rose was. And Jackie liked to mingle and host, but she wasn't really caught up in all the politics. There were plenty of times where, while visiting the house, Jackie would isolate herself or choose to sit out certain games because she just was overwhelmed by the family dynamics. But still, the wedding went on, because the sisters' vote wasn't as strong as the vote of John and Rose, who actually liked her. And it happened quickly. Their wedding was on September 12, 1953. She was 24 and he was 36. Jackie hated her wedding dress. It was beautiful, just not her style. Her mother actually had a huge hand in picking it out. But the dress became iconic and was actually designed by Ann Lowe, a black woman and a huge fashion designer at the time. The cake was enormous. The guest list was large, at least 800 people, and they dined on pineapple bowls. Photos from the afternoon's festivities were all smiles. Rose petals and rice were thrown to wish the bride and groom good luck. They would need all the luck they could get because John F. Kennedy loved women. Jackie knew this about him before they got married. He was the consummate ladies' man, and it definitely didn't change after they got married. It was a hard pill to swallow that her husband was always going to have eyes for other women. But I think for Jackie, it was a flaw she was willing to work with for some reason. It was very much giving he knows where home is. But JFK was said to have a huge sexual appetite, and she was not coy about it. There were rumors that JFK and his father had even slept with some of the same women. And of course, we all know about JFK and Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn was not the first woman to cross the line and claim that JFK was going to leave Jackie. It did become a little bit of an issue when Jackie found out that JFK had chlamydia and that he had possibly given it to her as well. In addition to the philandering, Jackie also became more and more aware of how sick her husband was. JFK frequently wore a back brace, and when he was young, he caught scarlet fever. Rose constantly worried about him being underweight and gave him extra broth and milk in the hopes that he could put on weight. As an adult, it was said that he had Addison's disease. We talked about her desire for perfection was down to even their teeth. For Rose, JFK was always too skinny, he was too sickly, and she was always trying to make him better. As an adult, he relied heavily on a team of physicians, and even in some cases, he was definitely a little over-medicated. Whenever Jackie was stressed, she turned to smoking cigarettes heavily and drinking. In 1955, she had a miscarriage and lost their first child. This was hard because compared to his other siblings, they all had growing families already. And in 1956, they would have a stillborn. This was particularly hurtful because JFK was not there. He was supposedly off with another woman while Jackie was in the hospital. It just seemed like more and more things were not working between the two. But obviously, divorce was extremely taboo, even though Jackie was a daughter to divorced parents. For JFK, divorce was basically unheard of. His father was notoriously unfaithful to his mother, and she stayed the entire time and endured, so why shouldn't Jackie? His mother coped with traveling. Whenever she had enough of Joseph's antics, she would take a trip. Frequently, Joseph wouldn't wait for her to come back home. She and the children would write to her about how much they missed her. But finally, November 27th of 1957, John and Jackie would have their first child, their daughter, Caroline. This would be a turning point for their relationship, and they would finally kind of feel like they were back on the right track. JFK is continuing to cheat during this time, but that's neither here nor there, I guess. A few years later, he decided to run for president of the United States. If you were even remotely familiar with U.S. history, you know that he won. But you may not know that Jackie played a huge part in his campaign behind the scenes. At first, they kind of wanted to keep Jackie in the background. They thought that she would make JFK unrelatable because of her background. But instead, her style and her education ended up being a huge benefit to them. She spoke Italian and was able to speak French to U.S. citizens down in Louisiana. She became an it girl. We have influencers now, and Jackie would have been like that if she were alive today. If Jackie wore her hair a certain way, then everybody was running out to get the haircut. If she had a certain dress, everyone was trying to get that certain dress. Jackie had fans, and there are some cases of them being at the family home in Hyannisport, and people literally trying to sneak onto the property to see or catch a glimpse of Jackie. Jackie and John would also have one more child, a son, John Jr., in November of 1960. 1960 would prove to be a good year for them because that's also the year that JFK won the presidential race. He became the youngest United States president at the age of 43, and Jackie was 31. A few years later, they would go on to have another child who unfortunately would pass away after just a few days. It was absolutely devastating for the couple, but unlike their previous complications, this actually brought them a little bit closer together. They are photographed leaving the hospital together, holding hands. Compare that to what we just mentioned earlier about him not even being there when they experienced a stillborn. Growth, I guess? They would make it to their 10-year anniversary. As a first lady, and because of her interest in art and history, she wanted to make sure that the historical significance of the White House was preserved. She is actually responsible for a lot of how we see the White House today. She was able to get portraits of people like Benjamin Franklin added to the White House. She knew how to charm people. I'm going to insert a trigger warning here. My history buffs will know that not long after their 10th anniversary, a little over a month or so, to be precise, JFK would be assassinated. He was campaigning in Dallas for his second presidential run. Jackie was excited to be there and support him, and she had hopes of supporting him in future campaigning. They were riding through Dallas in an open-top convertible, and they were waving at the people. In the book, America's Queen, it's mentioned that Jackie was told to keep her sunglasses off so that people could see her face. She was smiling. They were both smiling and waving. Jackie saw some citizens who spoke Spanish scream at her when they saw Jackie, who replied to them in Spanish. She waved at them too. It was like a joyous occasion. However, everyone was not so happy about it. Seemingly out of nowhere, John F. Kennedy was shot. Jackie describes the moment as very surreal. She doesn't remember seeing any blood at first, and then suddenly there was blood everywhere. The first shot would not have killed him, but he was shot again. His Secret Service was slow to react to the situation because everything was happening so quickly. The way that presidents would campaign for the rest of United States history was changed in this moment. Jackie's clothes were bloodstained with parts of his brain on her pink suit. She reached for the back of the car to grab a piece of JFK's brain. They told her that he had to get to a hospital, but she was confused because he was very much dead and she was very much aware of that fact. She put her wedding ring on his finger when they took him to the hospital where he was shortly pronounced dead. The next day, Jackie did not change out of those clothes, and she was said to have been in a state of shock. She also wanted the public to see what was done to her husband. There was a lot of theories surrounding who killed JFK and why. However, the man who was arrested for the crime is connected to communism, allegedly. Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested for the crime, but maintained that he was being set up. He was killed November 24, 1963, and so the theory about JFK's death was born. But no theory changes the fact that a woman's husband was shot and killed in front of her, and that two small children lost their father. She would eventually get that ring back and kept a small lock of his hair to remember him by. This event would also change so much about Jackie's personality. At the funeral, it is said that she held it together. Jackie definitely suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. She had a mood of depression. She had night terrors, and there were definitely times when she didn't even want to live anymore. She did have her children to think of, and I think they really anchored her. Slowly but surely, she began dating again. It was seen a bit scandalous at the time, and on October 20th, 1968, she married Aristotle Onassis, who was a wealthy Greek man. This was especially taboo at the time, but it offered Jackie a sense of escape. They would end up having a nasty divorce, of course. His children could not stand Jackie, and near the end, her husband really didn't want her to get much of his money. But Jackie came out on top and walked away with over $20 million. The rest of her life was spent pursuing journalism, preserving historical sites, and being there for her children. She always wanted them to have a normal life, even when they lived in the White House. Jackie sort of left politics behind for the most part. She would campaign from time to time for presidents like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, and she offered advice whenever she could to the White House. On May 19, 1994, she passed away due to her battle with lymphoma. Jackie Kennedy gets a lot of notoriety, but we don't often talk about the other daughter-in-laws that Rose Kennedy had. For starters, Ethel Kennedy, the widow of Bobby Kennedy. She came from an Irish-American family who started out with very little. But her father had a plan and was able to create one of the largest companies in America at the time, the Great Lakes Carbon Corporation. This left the family very, very well off. Unfortunately, she wouldn't get nearly as much time with her parents as she would have hoped. They both died in a plane crash when she was just 27. But before her young adulthood, Ethel was born in Chicago in 1928 to a very large family. She later attended the Manhattanville College of the Sacred Heart. Ethel was known for her witty humor and her rebellious spirit. During an interview with her youngest daughter, Rory, she tells the story of burning her school's demerit book so that she could go to a Yale versus Harvard game. She had too many marks and otherwise would have been unable to go. While at school, she and Gene Kennedy became good friends. The two of them decided to get their families together and go skiing. And that's how she and Bobby met, on a ski trip in Quebec. At first, Bobby was interested in Ethel's oldest sister, but when that didn't work out, he turned his attention to Ethel, who had her eyes on Bobby from the start. It honestly worked out for the better because they hit it off. After dating for a few years, they married in June of 1950. The wedding was huge, with over 600 guests in attendance and a large bridal party. The champagne was flowing to celebrate the happy couple. They would go on to have 11 children and were almost married for two decades. Bobby and Ethel loved to have fun together, and she really believed in him. Bobby Kennedy would go on to be the Attorney General of the United States while JFK was in office. After the death of his brother, Bobby continued his political career, and Ethel supported him. Even when he himself made the decision to run for president, she knew he could do it. In videos of Bobby, you can see Ethel right there beside him. He thanked her frequently for being his support. She admired how he wanted to make the country better. Much to the dismay of her very conservative parents, she was also starting to see the things the way Bobby did. She was exposed to so many different types of people and ways of living for the first time. With this, she became more and more interested in being involved. Even when JFK was running, she and her children were right there. She campaigned along the Kennedy sisters and helped with the tea parties too. She had a much more hands-on approach than Jackie. On one occasion, she got a little too involved and stole some horses who were being neglected. She was charged with theft, but ended up beating the case. Her children were also encouraged to take an interest in politics and the world around them. They were expected to stay up to date on current events and understand history. In this way, she was much more like Rose Kennedy. When the children grew older, they were sent off to travel and volunteer around the world. She believed in helping people, making their lives better. She was a supporter of the civil rights movement and movements that supported labor rights. She also thought very little of J. Edgar Hoover and wasn't shy about it either. But this exciting life that she and Bobby were creating took a bitter turn when JFK was killed, and even more tragic when Bobby himself was murdered a few years later. Ethel was actually pregnant with their last child together when Bobby was assassinated. Their daughter Rory would never meet their father. Ethel vowed that she would never remarry, and she kept that vow. When Bobby died, Ethel was left to look after the large family that they had created. She would end up having to bury two children of their own without Bobby, one being their son David. He was found dead in his hotel room after having overdosed. He had been battling heroin and alcohol addiction for many years since his father's assassination. Her other son, Michael, died in a ski incident. He was skiing and having fun with his family. They were playing football and he wasn't paying attention and he hit a tree. But despite the tragedies and losses that crept into Ethel's life, she wanted to still leave something positive in this world. She founded the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Center for Human Rights not long after Bobby was assassinated. According to the website, it exists to hold governments accountable at home and around the world. The website details initiatives for a variety of issues, including mass incarceration, gender-based violence, racial injustice, etc. Ethel and Bobby's daughter, Carrie, is currently the president of the organization. She also has a long list of other political involvements. She's marched with Cesar Chavez, sat with Native Americans in Alcatraz, demonstrated outside the South African and Chinese embassies, trekked up mountainous terrain in Mexico to visit unjustly convicted prisoners, and much, much more. It's no surprise that in 1981, she received the Robert F. Kennedy Medal from Ronald Reagan and the Presidential Medal of Freedom from none other than President Barack Obama in 2014. Ethel Kennedy is still alive today. You can even find a video on YouTube of her during the Ice Bucket Challenge. She's actually the mother of Robert Kennedy Jr., or RFK, who is currently running in the 2024 presidential election. The final two daughter-in-laws are Joan Bennett and Victoria Reggie. Both of these women married Ted Kennedy. Virginia Joan Bennett, usually called Joan, much like the people we've previously discussed on this episode, also attended Manhattan College. She also did a little modeling. In 1957, she found herself at the dedication of a gymnasium at her school. And who was the dedication for? None other than Kathleen Kennedy. It was there that she met Ted. Things moved very fast between the two of them. They were literally married a year and a month later. This speed made Kathleen very nervous. She barely knew this man. Obviously, the Kennedy family had a large reputation, but a reputation does not represent an entire individual. Ted was a little bit of a troubled child. He wasn't able to excel in the same way as his siblings. He ended up in the military, which definitely gave him the much needed structure to turn things around. He would go on to take JFK's spot in the Senate. But she really liked politics and, much like Ethel, assisted heavily in his campaign for re-election as senator, and he won. His political career was moving in the right direction. She is still beside Ted when he had to bury both of his brothers and his plane accident. This is what makes what Ted did all the more shocking. If you've ever seen the show Succession, this is going to sound familiar. Ted was driving one night and was involved in a car accident. He was leaving a party with Mary Jo Kopechne after offering to give her a ride. The car went off a bridge on the way to their destination. He made it out and claimed he tried to save her. He went and got his lawyer and cousin, and they were unable to save her. But somewhere in between, he still hadn't called for help. Ted jumped back into the water, then swam 500 feet back to land and walked to his hotel and did not call the police until 10 hours later. Mind you, he had called several other people once he reached the hotel. This is the version of the story that is the most straightforward, but there are a lot of inconsistencies. Maybe we dive into this another time in another episode. Mary Jo died in that car. Her body was retrieved the following morning. Assessments later determined that if she received the appropriate medical attention and that if Ted had acted quickly, she may have lived. It is possible she didn't die from drowning, but slowly suffocated. There was likely an air pocket in the car keeping her alive until oxygen just ran out. Joan was shocked to hear what happened. She suffered another miscarriage not long after and even attended Mary Jo's funeral. Ted would ultimately end up doing no jail time for the incident. Their relationship only got more complicated despite the fact that together they would have three children. Unfortunately, she would end up burying one of the children due to cancer later in life. They did not go on to have a larger family like some of the other Kennedys because Joan suffered from at least three miscarriages during their marriage. Due to the distress of it all, Joan went down a path of alcoholism. Her addiction would lead her down a very chaotic path. In 1978, they divorced. Her addiction would only tighten its grips on her. Her behavior became increasingly more self-destructive and dangerous. Her son was now her legal guardian. An ABC News article claimed that at her worst, Joan had been sneaking shots of vanilla extract and mouthwash to hide the smell of booze, according to the Boston Magazine. But she had been doing a little better these days and is still alive today. About a decade later, Ted married Victoria Reggie Kennedy. Now, Victoria is a completely different story. She's got roots down in Louisiana, and her family traces its lineage back to Lebanon. She was the second oldest in a family of six. Her family had money from their investments in the Bunny Bread Company. Next time you're in the store and you see that loaf of bread with a little blue bunny on it, that's her family. And as a result, they were also heavily involved in politics. In fact, they knew the Kennedys pretty well. Her father and JFK had crossed paths on more than one occasion, and her mom even voted for Ted Kennedy in 1980 at the Democratic National Convention. Victoria would also take an interest. She was a high achiever, straight top of her class in law school. As an attorney, her specialty was banking law. And in case you didn't know, Victoria is kind of a big deal in her own right. She is the president and co-founder of the organization Common Sense About Kids and Guns. She is a huge advocate for gun control and common sense policies around gun violence. The number one cause of death in this country for elementary age school children is guns. She is pro-choice, she served under Obama as the governor of the United States Postal, and she is a U.S. ambassador to Austria. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, she was in the news and is active on social media. So how exactly did she meet Ted? For her and Ted, both this would be a second marriage. She had children from her previous marriage, but Ted did not mind. They were a happy, blended family. Actually, they met at her parents' anniversary party. Similarly to this, his first wife, it only took them about a year before they were married. But Victoria was a very smart and accomplished woman. Ted was going to have to straighten up and fly right, and he did. She also motivated and encouraged him despite his checkered past. You can see so many smiling photos of them online. Towards the end of his life, she cared for him in his final days after he was diagnosed with brain cancer. When Ted died, a letter he sent to Pope Benedict surfaced. A portion of it reads, "I have been blessed to be a part of a wonderful family. Both of my parents, particularly my mother, kept our Catholic faith at the center of our lives. That gift of faith has sustained and nurtured and provided solace to me in the darkest hours." Many people speculated that she would also run for Senate, but she made it clear in an Oprah interview she had no interest. It will be interesting to see what the future holds for her. The Kennedys' legacy in general is one that we will continue to watch unfold for generations to come. But the next time you hear someone talking about Bobby Kennedy or JFK, feel free to mention Rose, or Rosemary, Kathleen, Eunice, Patricia, or Jean, Joanne, Victoria, Ethel, and Jackie, because they are just as much part of the Kennedy family legacy as the men. May this episode serve as a reminder that for many of the men in this country, there is a woman somewhere, whether it be a mother, sister, or wife, whose story goes untold and whose name you may not know, but you probably should. Until next time. This episode was written and researched by Jordan Howard, edited, produced, and narrated by Andre White. If you like this episode of the Redacted History Podcast, please consider leaving a rating, a like, a review, and more importantly, go subscribe. Go to our YouTube channel and our Patreon if you want to support us further and see further content. And follow us on Instagram at @redactedhistory_.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution Podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution Podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution Podcast.